This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Happy Saturday to you. Welcome on in to White Sox Weekly. White Sox just completed their first 500 month since 2023. They were 13-13 in the month of April, and they are currently on a season-high four-game win streak after they finished off a sweep of the Angels at Wrigley Field before heading out to San Diego to begin their West Coast trip, six in on the West Coast here on this current road trip, where they will take on the Padres for two more today and tomorrow, and then they will go to play the Angels that they just swept in L.A. So White Sox having a chance here to make some noise and continue to build on the good feelings that they have put forth right now in the early going. Started out a little bit slow to begin the season as the White Sox were 2-4 out of the gate. But to back that up with a 13-13 April, I think is really a nice step forward for the White Sox. And again, streaking right now, sweep of the Angels. And then last night, starting things off on the road against a very good San Diego Padres team who is 19-12. And a half game back of the Dodgers, thanks to the White Sox win last night. So a good test for the Sox here. And they did a great job of taking advantage of Herman Marquez, who was on the mound last night for the Padres. And I say that because the next couple of days for the White Sox are going to be stiffer competition when it comes to who they're going to be facing on the mound. They're going to get Michael King tonight. Sean Burke will be on the mound for the White Sox, and something else that I'm going to talk about a little bit, but Sean Burke, no opener tonight, something that the White Sox have been leaning into. So Burke on the mound as the starter. He gets Michael King, who has been one of the Padres' better starters, not just this season, but for the last few seasons. And then Randy Vasquez goes tomorrow for the Padres against the White Sox. And he's probably been the Padres' best starter this season, even though it's a small sample size. Anthony Kay on the mound for the White Sox, and he has struggled as of late. So huge test for Anthony Kay, as he's going to, I think, need to pitch better if he wants to remain in the White Sox rotation for long. And that's something that he will be tested with tomorrow. But first things first, again, Michael King, tougher matchup for the White Sox today. Herman Marquez, though, he came into yesterday's game with an ERA well north of four, and the White Sox rocked him. They win 8-2, and it was a homecoming for Will Venable. Will Venable spent eight seasons with the Padres as a player, so that was the vast majority of his career was spent in San Diego, so he knows the city and Petco Park very well. But it was his first time going back to his old stomping grounds as a manager, because last season the White Sox played the Padres at Wrigley Field. They did not take the trip to San Diego. So first chance for Will Venable to go back. And the White Sox did a nice job of getting him a win in his homecoming under the Friday Night Lights, which was always, I'm sure, meant a little bit more for Will Venable to get that win against his former team. Now, things did not start out great for the White Sox, because Noah Schultz in the first inning looked like it was going to be a short outing for him, because Schultz had to throw 29 pitches just to get through the first inning. He walked three batters, but to Noah Schultz's credit, with all the traffic on the base paths, he did not allow a run in the first. That proved to be critical, because the White Sox quickly gave him support in the top of the second, which I do think probably helped Noah Schultz settle down. But Sam Antonacci got the hit parade started, driving in the White Sox first run of the ballgame.
And a base hit right field over drawn in infield. Here comes Montgomery. He scores, and it's 1-0.
So Sam Antonacci picks up an RBI there in the second, and the White Sox continued. Austin Hayes delivers a second run.
Hayes hits a bouncer to third. Mydroth holds. They're going to get the out at second on a force play, and Tatis airmails to the plate, and Mydroth scores. Interesting play. Mydroth waited to see what Machado wanted to do. They get the force at second, and then Tatis's throw to home plate was nowhere close. It's 2-0.
Wild play on that one. Tatis actually did not get an error on the play because the double play was not going to happen. Now, like, Tatis recognized he was not going to be able to turn two, but then he fires home, and the official score deemed that he probably was not going to get him at the plate anyway. So no error on the play, despite the fact that he absolutely launched it over the catcher's head. And I think it's worth noting, Tatis playing second base, he was making just his sixth career start at second base for the Padres. So he's still kind of acclimating himself to that spot. Now, he's not moving to second base to be their primary second baseman. They have just utilized Tatis as a second baseman when they're giving Jake Cronenworth a day off, or sometimes Xander Bogaerts. If they give Bogaerts the day off, they shift Cronenworth to shortstop and then let Tatis play second. So he's still going to be their primary right fielder, and I think you probably want to keep him there because he is a platinum glove winner in right field. So he's excellent out there, but because of his flexibility and versatility as an infielder in his past, they've been utilizing him at second base a bit this year. And obviously that worked to the White Sox benefit. Andrew Benintendi came up and delivered a sac fly to push across a third run.
Two home and a chance to get a bunch more. There's a swing and a pop fly out into center. Johnson with back now comes in, has to make a sliding catch. Hayes is going to tag. He's going to score. Peters will advance to third. It's a sac fly, and it's 3-0.
That allowed Peters and Romo to move along, and that set the stage for Munetaka Murakami, who we cannot stop talking about. He continues to impress, even if you've already bought in and believe he's a superstar at this point. I think it seems like with each passing week, more and more people are starting to understand just how special this kid might actually be. And it came as no surprise to Darren Jackson yesterday.
The backbreaker is going to be the three-run home run right here by Murakami.
3-2, the runner moving from first, and a swing and a blast. Deep right center, gone. There's your three-run homer. It's 6-0.
It just had to happen, Len. It had to, as Marquez was so close to getting out of this with a lot of damage already done, but close to getting off the hook. So you knew with Mune due up, three more were on its way.
Look at that. DJ is getting so confident in Mooney, he's calling three-run shots when he steps into the batter's box. Murakami delivers his 13th home run of the season last night. That leads the majors. And, I mean, what more can you say, right? He's got a 967 OPS on the season. And the White Sox had a lot of improvement last year in the second half of the season. But maybe what other people didn't anticipate with the White Sox this year was adding a potential MVP candidate into the middle of the order. Well, you do that with any team, and all of a sudden, you're going to lengthen the lineup. You're going to add a lot more pop and production, and that is exactly what's happening for the White Sox. And when Murakami hits a home run, it seems like the White Sox offense truly gets going. So, yeah, they put up a six spot in the second inning. I'll call it a touchdown on Will Venable's homecoming. And that really did allow Noah Schultz to settle in after that. And I think most pitchers feel that way. You get them a six spot, they always feel much better. And what we saw after that was Noah Schultz attacking the strike zone, attacking the Padre hitters, and forcing them to go up and be aggressive. And he just allowed his defense to back him, which was nice because, again, after a laborious 29-pitch inning in the first, I thought there's no chance Schultz is going to qualify for a win. I thought, hey, if he can get through four and change, that would be a nice way to bounce back after that tough first inning. Well, boy, Noah Schultz proved me wrong almost immediately. He then, after, I made a note here, after 29 pitches in the first, I believe, the next three innings, Schultz had 27 pitches to get through the second, third, and fourth. So, yeah, after it looked like, okay, there's no way he's going to be able to qualify for a win with an almost 30-pitch first inning, Schultz ends up mowing the Padres down the next three innings. And at that point, he's through four with a, I guess I'd call it an economical 56 pitches. So like at that moment, you're like, okay, hey, he's got a 6-run lead and he's through four with 56 pitches. Now you're thinking, not only can he qualify for the win with another good inning, but he's got a real chance at a quality start here. And a quality start, if you're unfamiliar, that's the stat. You go 6 innings, 3 earned runs or less. And it's not the end-all, be-all, but I always say, hey, if a pitcher can give you a quality start, they've done their job. You know, now, they're not always going to get you a win, but 3 earned runs. And then the bigger factor nowadays is if a starting pitcher can give you 6 innings, like, you can't take that for granted anymore. I know it's, you know, from long ago, you'd expect 6 or 7 innings from a starter. We're not in that era anymore. So if a pitcher gives you a quality start, they've more than done their job, in my opinion, not only because they've given you a chance to win, but they've also saved your bullpen a little bit. Because a lot of times, a manager is asking their bullpen to cover, you know, 3-plus innings, 4 innings. That's kind of the norm these days. So anytime a pitcher can give you a quality start, that's a huge win. Noah Schultz did that again after 29 pitches in the first inning, which I think says something about the maturity, at least when it comes to baseball maturity on the mound as a pitcher. Schultz recognizing, okay, big lead, give my team some innings. He was able to do that, and I was really encouraged to see that again on the heels of another good start last Sunday that he made against the Nationals. Now, he didn't get the win because the White Sox ended up losing that game in extra innings. That was last Saturday, not Sunday. But he pitched really well, 6 innings, 2 earned runs, 8 strikeouts. So since we've last talked on White Sox Weekly, Noah Schultz has given the White Sox back-to-back quality starts and, you know, looked almost as good as he did when he was pitching for Triple-A Charlotte. So very encouraging sign. Another piece as to why I think White Sox fans can be very optimistic about where this team is at and hopefully where it's headed. Oh, I should have thrown out the number as always. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number if you want to jump on in, talk some White Sox with me. Always here for you. Again, White Sox Weekly on Saturdays. I always like to say it's essentially just extended pregame coverage for your pregame show, which will officially begin tonight at 7 with the White Sox. First pitch coming your way at 7:40 tonight as they look to claim the series from the Padres. And that's the nice thing about winning the opener. You always have a chance to knock the series down in that second game, and the White Sox have an opportunity to do that behind Sean Burke. I'll add a couple more highlights from this one. So this is an odd highlight. Not going to usually play a highlight like this on White Sox Weekly, but I loved it because this is exactly the type of player that Miguel Vargas is, and he is helping set the tone for the White Sox each and every game.
The pitch to Vargas. He swings and shoots a ground ball into left center, a base hit. He's digging hard around first. He's trying for two. The throw! In time on a close play, and he thinks he might have gotten in, and we're going to get a challenge from Will Venable.
Well, Vargas is not to be denied. He is that guy. He is going to make you throw him out, especially in a situation like this.
I don't know how you feel. Obviously, you want him to be safe, but even if he's out, I love the play.
Yes, that is just unbelievable hustle by Miguel Vargas, and fun to watch.
After review, the runner came off the base. He is out.
So it was disappointing in that Vargas actually came off the bag, but he beat the throw with his hustle. And I think initially it didn't seem like that was the case. And actually, that was not the call by the ump on the field. I believe he thought that the throw beat Vargas, but Vargas actually got under the tag and was at the base. Just not much he could do in that situation when your momentum carries you off of the bag. It was a great hustle play, and more of that. It's something that Vargas has shown all season long. He did it a lot last year as well. But I think the heart and soul of a team, when you have players doing that, busting it out of the batter's box every single time they make contact, you love to see it. And that enthusiasm can be infectious in the dugout and the clubhouse. Shortly thereafter, actually, how about the very next batter? In fact, Colson Montgomery went ahead and did this.
So two down, here's Colson Montgomery. First pitch swing, and he launches deep right, and it is gone. A home run. It's 7-0.
That's right. Colson Montgomery added his 9th home run of the season to back up Munetaka Murakami's 13th of the year. And those two, they love homering in the same game. This was a note I saw from Sarah Langs yesterday evening after this. This is already the 7th time this season that Murakami and Montgomery have homered in the same game. That's the most by any teammate duo in the team's first 35 games of a season in Major League Baseball history. By the way, the White Sox have only played 32 games, so they actually have 3 more games to go ahead and add to that total. Not saying they're going to, but they've got a chance to do so. They broke a tie with teammates who had 6 homers in their first 35 games. The 1956 New York Yankees, Mantle and Yogi Berra. 1980 Phillies, Mike Schmidt and Greg Luzinski, who we know here. And then 1994, the Coors-aided Colorado Rockies, the Andres Scalarraga, the Big Cat, and Ellis Burks. But the White Sox, Murakami, and Montgomery, they now stand alone in terms of dynamic duos to homer in the same game for the most amount of times in their first 35 games of a season. They've done it 7 times. And by the way, that note comes courtesy of Sarah Langs. Happy birthday to Sarah Langs. It is her birthday. And I will tell you that I don't know if there's a better ambassador for baseball as a fan than Sarah Langs. She's a great follow on Twitter and just always providing endless information. So happy birthday to Sarah Langs today. Could not, she makes me better at my job because of all the great facts that she provides. So a happy birthday to her. Plenty more to come. I do want to play for you Will Venable after the White Sox win last night. He commented on how Noah Schultz was able to battle back after that tough first inning. So I'll let you hear that when we come back. Also, get you a little preview of the Sox lineup and pitching matchup for today's game. Jesse Rogers is going to join me at 5:30. He actually has a piece coming out, I believe, later this week on Munetaka Murakami for ESPN.com. So we're going to talk to him a little bit about that and just general baseball stuff, as well as the White Sox. Good start to the season and their 4-game winning streak. Hey, Sox fans, join us for City Connect Fridays all season long. Catch the team in their iconic uniforms every Friday night and shop the full collection at the team store. For more information, head to whitesox.com/city. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. Again, when we come back, I'll get you today's lineups and also an announcement for the White Sox Minor League Players of the Month. We'll share that next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Hear Lennon DJ and High Def on 100.3 HD2.
Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for Mother's Day weekend. Come watch the White Sox Saturday, May 9th as they take on the Mariners at 6:10. First 15,000 fans will receive a woman's athleisure jacket presented by Rush. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. As I mentioned, Will Venable after the game yesterday, very pleased with his team's 4th straight win. He began by discussing Noah Schultz and his ability to battle through a tough first inning.
Yeah, you know, just got in the zone a little bit. You know, it's interesting watching him pitch where you feel like he's not really pitching his best and he's still really tough to deal with for the opposition. And I think that's just how good Noah is. He's still figuring it out and can be effective even when he doesn't have his best come in.
You see him get kind of fired up off the mound there in the third inning. He's a pretty low-key guy. It's not low-key, but even keel. It's kind of interesting to see him get that fiery in there.
Yeah, I think he's got that in him. You know, and he's a competitor. He wants to go out there and perform well. Obviously, he is performing well and understands that, you know, these pitches that he's making, these outs that he's getting are big outs. And, yeah, he's just a guy that likes to compete.
Just how you continue to see him improve piling up your outing.
Yeah, I mean, he just finds ways, you know. I think, you know, the self-awareness when something's not working, he can go to other pitches. He's got so many weapons. You know, he understands how to get to, you know, the next one if one's not working for him.
Does the strike zone seem smaller to you with this new challenge system? We're talking to people about that seems to be the perception.
Yeah, I think the zone has shrunk a little bit. You know, certainly some of these pitches on the edge. I think with the umpires knowing that there's challenges available, they're tightening up a little bit, and we're seeing some calls overturned. And yeah, I think it's shrinking the zone. I think the walk rate around the league is up because of it as well.
It is indeed. And speaking of overturned calls, we've got one heck of a celebrated overturned call coming your way later here on White Sox Weekly. As I mentioned, the White Sox did name earlier today their minor league players of the month. Hagen Smith and Caleb Bonnemer were named the pitcher of the month for the minor leagues. Hagen Smith is at Triple A Charlotte right now. He had a 2.33 ERA. Opponents had a batting average of 162 against him. He recorded 29 strikeouts in 19 and a third innings pitch over his six starts in March and April. And then Caleb Bonnemer, got a lot more to talk about with him. He has been absolutely crushing the baseball. Right now, Bonnemer, who is 20 years old as he plays for the Class High A Winston-Salem Dash, he's got 11 homers, 27 RBIs, 11 walks, 22 runs scored, an 1146 OPS over his 23 games in April. He's been absolutely mashing. Paul Janisch, the White Sox Director of Player Development, joined us earlier in the week, and I'm going to let you hear from him. Caleb Bonnemer, a big topic of discussion in addition to Hagen Smith. So the White Sox minor league players of the month right now. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, ESPN baseball insider Jesse Rogers joins me. He's got a new feature on Munetaka Murakami dropping later this week. We'll chat to him about that and plenty of other White Sox issues right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
The backbreaker is going to be the three-run home run right here by Murakami. 3-2, the runner moving from first, and a swing and a blast. Deep right center, gone. There's your three-run homer. It's 6-0.
It just had to happen, Len. It had to, as Marquez was so close to getting out of this with a lot of damage already done, but close to getting off the hook. So you knew with Mune due up, three more were on its way.
Munetaka Murakami last night with his league-leading 13th home run as the White Sox throttle the Padres 8-2 in their series opener. Mooney's turned Darren Jackson clairvoyance. That's the type of impact he's making across baseball. He keeps delivering and doing crazy things each and every day. Hey, Sox fans, families eat free. Grab your family and head to the ballpark this season with a family pack starting at $21. Each family member gets one hot dog, drink, chips, and a cookie. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. Come on out and see a Murakami home run in person for yourself. That is not guaranteed, but obviously you have a good chance of seeing him do it if you come to the ballpark. Again, 13 home runs leads baseball. Jesse Rogers, insider for ESPN.com, joins us now here on White Sox Weekly. Jess, I know that I've been talking to you in the clubhouse a little bit over the last few days. Mm-hmm. I know you've been working on a piece regarding Munetaka Murakami that is set to drop in the not too distant future. And he's on a heater, man. He keeps doing it. And what are your initial thoughts about Mune and what you've seen so far, you know, 32 games into the season?
Yeah, I mean, as you'd expect, he is surprising the league. You know, half the story is how's he doing it as a rookie, at least rookie in Major League Baseball, of course, played professionally over there in Japan, but to do it so quickly and so effortlessly in some ways, and he showed that back in spring, the swing is so good, but there's more to it. So that's kind of half the storyline. The other half of the storyline is, how did so many teams kind of miss on him? How did some of these teams that spend a lot of money every year not make him some big offer like you would normally to a big time home run hitter? And so it's, how did he land with the White Sox? How did other teams miss him? And of course, what he's doing right now. And let's get to what he's doing right now, because the home runs are great. Okay, if you just watch the highlights, they're going to show the pitch that he hits for a home run, and he's hitting, you know, hitters pitches for home runs, and that's great. He should be doing that, and he's doing that, but not like everybody does it, but he's doing it at a very peak version of it in the first month. But the key is laying off the bad pitches to get to the good ones, Jeff. And yep, that is what is elite about him so early in his career. Yesterday was a great example. Marquez walks him in his first at bat. So already it's in his head, I gotta get around the zone to get this guy to swing. And then in that second at bat, the pitch before the home run is a curveball just below the zone. He lays off it, and the next pitch is dead center, and he nails it for a three-run homer. And we've seen this over and over again, laying off borderline pitches to get to the hitter's pitches and doing damage with it. That is elite stuff. And I think it's fooled the league in some ways. Mm-hmm. It surprised the league in some ways. And it's a lot of fun to watch.
No, that is critical, Jesse, that his ability, he's not expanding the zone. Yes, he's got a lot of, you know, swing and miss in his profile. And even, you know, I know it's probably something that you cover in the piece when it drops. I can't wait to read it. But the fact that other teams, I think, were concerned about his in-zone contact rate, right? He's amongst the lowest in the league when it comes to that. But it doesn't matter, or at least we're seeing right now, it is not something that is, you know, changing his game, because he just lays off the stuff that's out of the zone, forces the pitches to come in. Obviously, he's not going to hit a home run every single at bat, so he does have a high strikeout rate, but because he doesn't swing at stuff outside the zone, pitchers have to come in. They're either walking him, they're striking him out, or he's hitting a home run. He's the definition of a three true outcome player. And what's huge right now is that, hey, he's only got a .239 batting average. He's got 13 home runs. Those are the only extra base hits that he has. But that on-base percentage is .383. The slugging is .584. Hey, a .967 OPS. Every team in baseball could use a guy like that plugged into the middle of their lineup.
Yeah, I know it's pretty simple, but three true outcomes. Well, two of them are good. Two are positive. One is a negative. But at least that one is, people would say, like, he's not hitting the double plays.
Yes.
Like, you know, that kind of thing. Like, you'd rather have the strikeout rate than some ground ball rate that is ridiculous. Like, it really is Kyle Schwarber-esque. That's what it is. That's the profile right now. 32% K rate, but a 19% walk rate, which is in the 98th percentile in baseball. 27 walks to 46 Ks. You will take that for a slugger in this day and age. And the chase rate, just 21%, also right around 90 percentile in baseball in a positive way. So it is Schwarber-esque. And let's get to why so many teams missed on him. I spent time today at Wrigley Field in the Arizona Diamondbacks locker room. Well, he had a hell of a series against the Diamondbacks about a week ago.
Yes.
He went 7-for-15, I believe, couple home runs. So I talked to several pitchers that gave up home runs to him, including Merrill Kelly and Ryan Thompson, who gave up a home run on his only pitch to him, dead center. And this is what Ryan Thompson had to say about facing Munetaka.
There's hardly any scouting that goes into him because you don't know anything about him. And all we know is the way that he's hitting here is very different than the way he was hitting in Japan.
In what way?
His holes are not his holes anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The reason why maybe other teams weren't pursuing him was because, I don't know. I think that,
at the gym?
I'm not sure the exact details, but I've heard chatter that he had different holes.
I think you're right.
When he was with Japan.
Think about that. I mean, he is profiling completely different than what teams thought. And in my story, I'm going to document how many teams kind of passed up on him. As you can imagine, it's a lot because it was big market, small market. You know, part of it is teams didn't believe him in as a third baseman.
Yep.
They certainly weren't sure of him as a first baseman, and nobody wanted to necessarily spend big money for a DH. Even the $17 million the Sox are spending each of the 2 years, that's a lot for a DH that has supposed holes in his swing. So a lot of reasons why he fell to the White Sox. Kudos to them for taking that leap, and for him and his agents kind of directing themselves to Chicago for a lot of different reasons, and it's all working out in the White Sox favor.
And it's still early, so it's hard to look at fielding metrics to see how good of a first baseman he is, but he's shown an ability. You know, he's athletic, he moves well, and because he still is kind of learning that position, he's done a really nice job of, you know, digging a lot of balls out of the dirt. I can tell you firsthand, I know you're covering the entire league, so you don't get to see every single play. I do. I'm telling you, he's done a nice job of digging out a lot of balls out of the dirt and saving the White Sox from errors that way. So he looks like he's, you know, at least athletically capable of handling the position, you know. So we'll see how the fielding metrics fare for him when we get a little bit more of a sample size. But he looks at the very least like he can handle it athletically, which is, I think, half the battle. And I'll add, it's interesting to hear that Ryan Thompson sound about, you know, his holes weren't his holes in Japan. I know one of the big criticisms and one of the reasons a lot of people suspected other teams were not necessarily as interested, they were like, hey, can he really handle high heat, the velocity? That was the question. You know, if his in-zone contact rate is, you know, sub 70% in Japan, what's it going to be like when he comes over to Major League Baseball? I think one of the problems is that other teams just were, they didn't want to take the chance because they just assumed that he couldn't hit high velocity. One of the things is sometimes you don't know what a player can do when they've never actually been challenged. And I think that's one of the differences between a Japanese player who's coming over to professional baseball for the first time versus maybe a veteran player who played in the majors once, went over to Japan, had some success, and then came back over. There's not as much velocity in Japan. That's the reality of the situation. So Murakami might actually be able to handle this the more often he sees it. He's still young enough in his prime where I think, you know, that could be part of the reason why other teams might have been a little bit scared to take the chance. And their loss, White Sox's gain.
Yeah, I would say that for some of the contending teams, it's a risk in that moment because you're paying $17 million a year at the very minimum. And if you strike out on the signing, no pun intended, that's a huge hole for you. You've signed him to be a power hitter and all of a sudden he can't hit velocity. So maybe you sort of understand why some of these teams had some trepidation. But I go back to what you said, just because you haven't seen him do it doesn't mean he can't do it. And so he's certainly proven that he can. I suspect he's going to get a ton of breaking stuff moving forward. There's a lot of swing and miss so far with the breaking stuff. He's hitting 184 on breaking pitches, 21 strikeouts, and on a bats that end on a breaking pitch compared to 17 against the fastball, and he's seen many more fastballs. So here's the problem, though. Not everybody can land a breaking pitch in the zone, and if you can't land it in the zone like that pitch before the home run yesterday, he's going to lay off of it. So only the really good pitchers can, you know, continually land those breaking pitches in the zone. And that's the guys that will get him out. It looks like, but if you're going to challenge him, he's going to hit it. And if you're going to miss with a breaking pitch, he's going to lay off it more often than not. And in fact, the next at bat, I believe when he flew out, he did hit a pitch down below the zone, but that's not been the norm for him. He's laid off most of those pitches.
Jesse Rogers joining me for another couple minutes here on White Sox Weekly. Okay, so cannot wait when that piece drops later this week, we're thinking. I know it's not entirely up to you, but...
Yeah, no, I think it'll be no earlier than Thursday. It's going to be Thursday or Friday, so probably Friday when they get back from their road trip at ESPN.com. It's going to, you know, sort of document again what he's done on the field and then what happened in the offseason. I mean, I could list the teams that passed on him and different reasons why, but we'd be talking for another 20 minutes because it's quite something. And I guarantee you some teams are kicking themselves. And I will tell you one team that did not have doubts, but just simply didn't have the money, the team he's playing right now. And I would have loved to seen AJ Preller's face last night when he crushed that ball, because what I'm told, the Padres did like him a lot. They just could not afford him because San Diego is out of money right now, at least until their new ownership takes over. So they're one team that actually believed in him, and then he comes back and haunts them in day one. There's other teams that simply didn't believe in him. The Mets are at the top of that list, and boy, they could have used him after Alonso left.
Well, it's a good thing the Padres didn't reach their deal to sell until today, officially. So, but we'll hit on that later. Okay, so a little more on the White Sox, not sure. In the Murakami bucket. Colson Montgomery, when Murakami homers, Colson's gone out and done it seven times himself. He, you know, kind of picked up in this right where he left off in the second half last year, you know, and he's played a very solid, you know, defense at shortstop this year. You know, are you surprised? Are scouts surprised by what they've seen from Colson Montgomery and the impact that he's made in his short time, you know, roughly 102-103 games as a member of the White Sox?
I mean, not entirely. Obviously, the arc was really strange, right? It looked like he might be a first-round bust for a moment in time. Like, you just didn't know. But it's a reminder, you got to give young players time to grow, and no path is most paths are not linear. There's steps forward and steps backwards. So now that he's proven himself, people I talked to are like, oh, yeah, this was the first-round pick. This is a big, strong shortstop. This is why they took him when they did. It just that the path was so weird, and it looked like I said, for a moment, it may not work out for him, but it finally has. So people are less surprised now than how it all went down last year, where he went back to Arizona and then had that incredible second half. So it's like he's already established himself, and people are expecting more of the same. And it's been a great combo, those two at the plate hitting home runs.
What did you make, Jess, of the Red Sox firing Alex Cora, the Phillies parting way with Rob Thompson, making Don Mattingly their interim manager, and then the Mets right now standing by Mendoza? What are your thoughts about two manager firings and then another that it seems like it's getting the noise is getting very loud in New York?
Yeah, and Houston could be next as well. I mean, all these sort of big money payroll teams, you know, firing their managers. You know, Boston to me is interesting because they didn't replace Cora with kind of like another veteran grizzled manager to calm the waters or anything like that. They went down and got a younger guy, AAA manager, with 5 months left in the season. So it's not like you're not giving away the year when you fire your manager on May 1st or close to it. You think you could turn it around. And it's obvious to the front, at least to me, that the front office didn't believe Cora, a veteran manager, was connecting with a younger Boston Red Sox roster. Mm-hmm. And so they go down to get Chad Tracy, who has managed those guys. So I'm kind of fascinated by that dynamic. Cora is either going to be vindicated or he might actually look bad in the end. Having said that, Craig Breslow has kind of made a mess of things all over the place. So he better hope Chad Tracy and this young roster connect and do something. So far, you know, sort of mixed reviews. We'll see. So I do find it interesting that they chose this younger manager. We've seen younger managers have some success lately. The guy in Washington looks great right now. Baltimore as well. It seems like they've turned things around a little bit. So I am interested to watch Boston under Chad Tracy. I was around Philly recently before they fired Rob Thompson. And it's just one of those things, like when Girardi ran its course, Rob Thompson was the right fit. And now Rob Thompson ran its course, and now you got to go with someone else. I do feel like going to Don Mattingly isn't like this is going to save the season kind of move. Mm-hmm. I think they're just relying on Bryce Harper and Kyle Schwarber to lead them out of this darkness that they're in right now. And it may not happen, And in fact, I think the only chance the Phillies have is if Jesus Luzardo and Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola find it all together and just, you know, go to town with Christopher Sanchez, and that's the way out for them is their starting staff. I don't think Don Mattingly's going to move the meter. I really don't.
It's interesting, Jess, because the Phillies have made the postseason four straight years. That's great, you know, but of course they haven't actually been able to finish it off and win a World Series. So fans are frustrated. I'm sure, you know, Dombrowski, the ownership group there, they were all frustrated with how it played out. Right. But when you look at it, you say, yeah, but you had a successful run. And here's the problem. You've brought back the same core now that is 4 or 5 years older than when they made that run the first time. And part of it just might be, you mentioned it, yeah, Lizardo needs to turn it around. He's young enough where he should. But Wheeler, he's coming back from that injury, the thoracic outlet syndrome. And of course, Nola, he's no spring chicken. Sometimes that age, it sneaks up on you. You run it back and everyone feels good about how you look in the offseason. And then all of a sudden you get out there and it's 5 years removed from the first time you made that playoff run. And you're like, hey, wait a minute. These guys now are 35 years old. They're not in the prime of their career. Sometimes that just comes for you too. And that's, I think that might be part of it in Philadelphia. One last one here for you, Jess, before I spring you. So, baseball with the Dodgers, you can't avoid them when we're talking about it. Shohei Ohtani, the Dodgers are giving him a little bit more of a break, it seems like, this year. When he makes his starts, he hasn't always been in the lineup. Part of that is Dave Roberts wants him to keep him fresh for the playoffs. But also, it seems like he's really got his mind set on making a run at the Cy Young. Do you think Ohtani can actually, I mean, I think he has all the talent in the world to do it. Do you think he will do it this year?
I'm going to say no, because it just, he really is a robot. But I guess if they do take care of him in the ways we're talking about here, there is that chance. I would never put anything past him, but to keep doing both those things at such a high level, even with the rest he's getting, it would be kind of shocking. So I'll say no, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did.
Great stuff as always, Jess. Can't wait for the Murakami article to drop. You know, I'll be reading it and also relaying excerpts next week on White Sox Weekly. So thanks for doing the work that you do, because White Sox fans, I'm sure, are going to be excited to check it out. And as always, thanks for joining me here on White Sox Weekly, man.
You got it, Jeff. Have a great night. Talk
you
to you
too. Soon. Jesse Rogers, again, ESPN MLB insider. He's got the Murakami piece that he's been working on for some time now. That drops hopefully at the end of the week here. So we obviously will be reading and combing through that when it does publish on ESPN. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. Grab your friends and head to the park for Miller Lite Baseball and Brews. Get one ticket and two beers starting at $24. Must be 21 and over with a valid ID to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/brews. When we come back, I'll get you tonight's lineup for the White Sox. And also, we've got Paul Janisch, the White Sox Director of Player Development, who met with the media earlier this week. A lot to talk about. A farm report with the man in charge of developing the White Sox young talent. We'll do that at 6 o'clock right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games on the go, the ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller, hanging out with you. Extended pregame Sox coverage, as I like to call it. Pregame will officially begin at 7, and first pitch comes your way at 7:40 tonight. Sean Burke gets the rock for the Sox. Burke 1-2 with a 3.21 ERA, 1.04 whip in 33 2/3 innings pitched. And he has also struck out 24 in those 33-plus innings of work and was really good his last time out when the White Sox used Brian Hudson as an opener last Sunday against the Nationals, a game that actually would eventually lose in extra innings 2-1. But Burke, 7 1/3, which was a career high in terms of innings worked, no runs allowed, struck out 4, really, really efficient with 76 pitches in that one. It was a great outing for Sean Burke, and he gets the chance to start today against the Padres. Again, that's not something that has always been the case, as this year in his he's had that opener. So we shall see how the White Sox continue to utilize Sean Burke this year. But again, I do think, because sometimes it can be, you know, hit up that third time through the order, it's something that we're going to have to monitor and see how it goes. But if he pitches well today, then I think Will Venable certainly will be more open to allowing him to start, you know. But it's part of, hey, can you give me, you know, can you get deep into a game without an opener? That's the question, because I don't think you can argue with the results the last time out for Sean Burke. For the White Sox, the starting lineup looks like this. It will be Andrew Benintendi leading off, just as he did yesterday as the DH. Munetaka Murakami with his league-leading 13 home runs, batting second. Miguel Vargas will man the hot corner and bat third for the Sox. Colson Montgomery cleaning up, playing shortstop. Chase Meidroth batting fifth. Sam Antonacci hits sixth in left field. That is actually the same top six as yesterday. Here's where it gets a little bit different from yesterday's lineup. Edgar Caro will be in the lineup and batting seventh. Jared Kelnick gets his first start for the White Sox in right field tonight. And then Tristan Peters will make another start for the White Sox in center field. And that will round out the White Sox lineup today. For the Padres, it'll be Ramon Laureano in left field leading off. Fernando Tatis Jr. back hitting second, but he's in right field today. Jackson Merrill gets the start in center field. He had the day off yesterday. He's been struggling a little bit, only hitting 200 on the season so far. Manny Machado cleans up and bats third. I'm sorry, plays third, cleans up. Xander Bogaerts, shortstop, hits fifth. Gavin Sheets, the sixth hitter, playing first base. Of course, we're very familiar with Gavin Sheets' game here in Chicago. And actually, he's going to be the center of our Sunday spotlight tomorrow as Len Casper sat down with him. And we'll share that with you as we do every Sunday when Len has spotlights somebody aside from Will Venable in what is usually the manager's show spot during our pregame coverage. Miguel Andujar DHing bats seventh. Luis Camposano catches and bats eighth. And then Jake Cronenworth, the second baseman, batting ninth for the Padres today. When we come back, we will let you hear from White Sox Director of Player Development, Paul Janisch. But before we do that, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Caleb Bonnemer is absolutely mashing. When will he be promoted? Paul Janisch gives us a little bit of insight regarding that and all the other key members inside the White Sox organization that you're probably wondering about yourself. We'll do that next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
And the 0-1 is lifted in the air to deep right. Polanco is back at the wall, and it's gone. A home run for Caleb Bonnemer. On the way. Hit in the air to deep left. White Jr. heads back. He looks up. It is gone. A home run. How about a two-home run game for Caleb Bonnemer? In the air. Deep left field. White Jr. is back at the track, at the wall. It is gone! A home run! Three home runs in one game for Caleb Bonnemer.
How about a three home run game for Caleb Bonnemer, Winston-Salem Dash play-by-play guy? Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. As always, if you want to join the conversation, 312-332-3776. That's the number to talk some White Sox with me every Saturday, 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage, but it's essentially extended pregame coverage for you friends. So always feel free to keep that number handy if you want to talk some Sox with me. And why wouldn't you? They've won four in a row, season high, looking good, rolling right now on the West Coast trip that they just began last night with a win in San Diego after sweeping the Angels right out of town. So good vibes going right now for the Sox. Munetaka Murakami absolutely launching dongs all over the place. Colson Montgomery adding home runs as well. Just everything looking good. Noah Schultz with a beautiful outing last night. Six shutout innings, picking up his second career victory as a major leaguer. So lots to be excited about for the White Sox, and they'll try and win the series tonight in San Diego as a 7:40 first pitch here. But yes, Caleb Bonnemer, he is just destroying baseballs in high A Winston-Salem. He was actually named the White Sox Minor League Player of the Month, at least for the hitters. Hagen Smith earned the honors for pitchers, but Bonnemer, who's 20 years old, he is slashing .284, .396 with a .750 slug, 11 homers, 27 RBIs, 11 walks, 22 runs scored, and an 1146 OPS in 23 games for Winston-Salem. And oh, by the way, wanted to bring this to you. Perfect time here now. Kylie McDaniel has just updated his May prospects across baseball inside each organization. And Caleb Bonimer probably should not come as a surprise, but he is now, according to ESPN.com, the White Sox top prospect organizationally. The way he's been just crushing baseballs right now, he was good last year, but I think he finished with about 10 home runs. In a month, he has 11. He added some weight. He's gotten a little bit thicker, and he looks like, you thought he was good last year, he looks even better right now. Again, it's only high A, but I think people are very excited about Caleb Bonimer and what he might bring to this team, you know, when he gets a chance to finally make his way through the minor league system. Noah Schultz is currently the second prospect in the White Sox org, according to Kylie McDaniel. Braden Montgomery ranks third. Billy Carlson, fourth. Tanner McDougal is fifth. I do want to mention McDougal suffered a strained flexor tendon, so he's dealing with that right now. That's never good for a pitcher. You hate to see that because a lot of times that is a precursor to Tommy John. I'm not saying that Tanner McDougal needs that, but you hate to see when a pitcher is dealing with a strained flexor tendon. And right now, Tanner McDougal was placed on the injured list this week when he left his start. So that is a bummer. Obviously, the more information we get, we will share it with you as soon as we have it. Hagen Smith is the sixth prospect in the Sox system. Christian Apor, lefty pitcher, is ranked number seven. Antonacci is eighth. William Bergola is ninth, and then Jaden Fowski ranks 10th. Again, this is Kylie McDaniel of ESPN.com's updated ranks for May, and those are your top 10 prospects inside the White Sox organization. A man who knows about all these players and everybody else, White Sox Director of Player Development, Paul Janisch. We had a chance to talk with him during the last game of the White Sox previous homestand, and we began things talking about Caleb Bonimer, and, you know, the question was broached. Man, he's killing it. How soon until he actually might get a promotion?
He's doing a great job. Yeah, obviously the big night last night, but that team right now is contagious. We're internally, like, pretty excited about Winston, you know, what's going on there, and give Guillermo Quiroz a ton of credit, man. Like, he's just got this ability to, you know, make players comfortable, make them better. And yeah, Caleb's, him and Colby Shelton at this point are, you know, two of the best hitters in the minor leagues, arguably. And yeah, fired up for Caleb.
How do you kind of base it? I mean, obviously he's killing it. He had three home runs last night. I think he has 10 and 25 and 22 games. He's also just turned 20, right, not too long ago. So he's certainly got time to develop. You don't want to push it, but then again, you want to challenge him, right?
Yeah, I think that's the best way to say it, just continuing to challenge him. We know Caleb well enough to know that, like, it's an elite competitor, right? Like, we love his ability. I still believe the bat's probably going to carry him as quickly as anybody. You know, defensively, we're still working on some stuff, and like I've mentioned before, he continues to grind on that side of the ball as well, but yeah, he's up to this point, again, he's answered challenges in a unique way for, you know, age relative to level and that kind of stuff. But yeah, so we'll monitor it closely and keep an eye. And there's a lot of value too, I think, to keeping that core group together for a little bit, just so that they can continue to, first of all, play well, but get to know each other over the course of time. Like, I feel like that's an important dynamic to create, like, within the organization. Hopefully, fast forward, when guys get the opportunity to play in the big leagues together, I think knowing each other is a big deal.
I don't think anyone doubted he had power, especially in the long term, but, you know, he's close to his last year's total already. What has he done to, like, see him actualizing in games as rapidly as he's doing it?
Yeah, I just think that he's starting to understand himself better, and, like, knowing, you know, pitch types and who he can kind of take chances against, and like, physically, he's bigger and stronger than he was last year, right? Like, if any of you guys saw him in spring training, I mean, he looks like a linebacker, right? Like, he's just put together really well, and I think even from like a recovery standpoint, maintenance within the season, he continues to do a really good job. We actually, like, kind of give him a hard time. He's fanatical about his diet and the way that he, you know, what he puts into his body and those kinds of things.
You mentioned Colby Shelton. What's impressed you about him so far?
Yeah, I mean, like, anybody that's hitting 420, like, a month into the season, I think is worth talking about. But, you know, and even with Colby, like, you know, some guys will point to, you know, how he did in Canapolis last year. I'm a believer that, you know, in the year that they get drafted, if they get out to the affiliate, you know, if they struggle, there's just so many variables that are involved there. You just don't put much weight into it. Colby had a really good offseason, and really, like, kind of the narrative that we shared with him was really just focusing on what he's good at, and that's, you know, the ability to hit the ball hard and really getting as many A swings off as he can, and, like, giving him the peace of mind that, like, hey, man, if you swing and miss a little bit, it's okay. You know, when we get to two strikes, we'll have that approach as well. But, yeah, and again, that's kind of what I was highlighting when we were talking about Caleb is, you know, those guys being together for as long as we can, while they're going well, they feed off of each other, and it kind of it you know, perpetuates itself within that clubhouse, and that's something that we value and hopefully can kind of capture.
Talk about, you guys are pretty optimistic about Matthew Botten out of the draft and the athleticism, but you also thought it might be a more gradual build offensively, but he obviously earned his way to Kannapolis. What do you kind of show to, you know, get that?
Yeah, you know, in a different way, like, obviously you treat them all individually, but, like, we've got some young promising players in Kannapolis, and one of the considerations there with Matthew specifically was letting those kids grow up together, right? You talk about Billy, you talk about Jaden, Matthew, I would include in that group of, like, look, a core of those guys that, you know, have some unique ability over the course of time, I think is really intriguing. So that was really the biggest thing, getting them there with those guys and letting them play together, letting them struggle together. You know, it's just I think it's a really powerful thing over the course of time. But he's doing really well. Like, all those guys, I think we're going to see some inconsistency throughout the year with that group because they're young. But we're going to see them do some cool things, and we're going to see them probably do some bonehead things, which is okay. It's part of it.
With that, just Hagan, just how did you start seeing him progress over the first
place? Yeah, I mean, I think Hagan would tell you he gets frustrated with himself a little bit with the inconsistency. That being said, like, overall, it's been pretty good, right? If you look at where we were 12 months ago and kind of where we are now, when he throws the ball over the plate, he has success. And, you know, when he gets himself in trouble, he's just not efficient, right? Like, numbers-wise, they look really good in a really offensive place. So I am super encouraged where he's at. I think he would, you know, if he was sitting up here, he would tell you the same thing. He's not quite satisfied with it, but he knows what he has in front of him. You know, we talk about the success that Noah's had. Those guys are really close. You know, Tanner's not far behind, obviously. And again, going back to it, you have a nucleus of guys that are really talented, and also, like, they get along, but they're competing too with each other, and they all want to be good. So I think that's something that, again, that we can really, like, leverage a little bit. But Hagan's in a good spot. He's healthy and whatnot. It's just about being more efficient.
With this team being so young, you know, Drew Romo was saying that they were watching this team in Charlotte, and just now you're seeing this team come together. Just kind of what has been the reaction up and down the minors, and just how this group's coming together?
Yeah, I would say, like, excitement, right? There's momentum, right? Like, you think about words like that, but one thing I think we do a pretty good job, we emphasize on the PD side, is, like, kind of a teammate mentality, right? And so, like, a lot of these guys, they know each other. Obviously, Drew's a unique circumstance. He didn't come up with us, but he's with us now. He's part of the family. Obviously, had a great night last night. And I think that we see that throughout the system, right? Like, the Winston-Salem Dash are watching the White Sox games on TV. They are around those guys during spring training. They get to know them, you know, and things happen quick. You know, you look at Sam Antonacci. He was in Winston-Salem at this time last year, right? Like, he's playing a significant role for the Major League team, and guys see that. And, you know, I joke about it. Players are dumb, but they're not stupid, kind of thing. And so, like, you have that carrot for them. It's like, you know, if you play well enough, you're going to get your opportunity too. And again, I go back to it. We talk about it a lot internally, the teammate mentality of, like, you know, they care about each other. They're competing with each other. You know, if everybody wants to get to the big leagues and play good, but at the end of the day, like, we're in this thing together.
For Colson, it's been 1 year to date since he went down to Arizona with Brian Fuller. Just what's the biggest area of growth that you've seen from him just this past year?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, if you asked us a year ago, we'd be sitting here today and he would have done what he's done at the Major League level. I think everybody would be pretty fired up. And, you know, I'm in town not all the time, but even like this week, I'm exchanging with Colson, and, you know, I joke with him because he has had the success, but I'm like, hey, man, you look happy, right? Like, he's enjoying it. And it goes back to the previous question about, like, teammates, and, like, I think these guys really like who they're playing with. I think they really like coming to the park, and, you know, we've seen it, right? Like, a couple nights ago, they were battling back late in games, like, kind of a never-say-die deal. But, yeah, I would tell you, like, my personal opinion on Colson is, you know, he's a unique talent. He's playing great defense. You know, whatever position he's open to do, whatever we'll ask him to do, which I think is, like, such a tribute to his character. Obviously, offensively, he's a huge part of this lineup. And, you know, again, I would just say, like, he's the type of player that has, like, a major league mentality. You know, we talked a lot about him struggling a little bit in the minor leagues, but I just believe that he believed he was a major league player, and like I think that's what we're seeing.
A year ago, did you sense he wasn't happy? Obviously, aside from, you know, struggles, he had struggled for a while at that point. Did you sense that there was frustration kind of building up a little too much there?
Yeah, I think that he was adding, you know, undue pressure, as a lot of players do. What I will give him credit for is that, like, in, you know, having the context that we have, he was never kind of productive to, like, teammates, to staff. He was, you know, again, a tribute to his character, but I think he expects a lot out of himself, which is why I think he's going to have success at the major league level. I never played with any players that were really, really good that didn't expect a lot out of himself, and I think he's one of those.
Kalanick was making a lot of tweaks in spring training, and obviously the results weren't there at the start of the season. What have you seen to, like, kind of the turnaround of results that we've seen from Big Big Farm when you kind of see that went into it?
Yeah, man, I would be remiss if I don't give a ton of credit to, like, our hitting group and our AAA staff in general, but Ryan Fuller in the hitting group specifically, just helping him get into a good spot. Like, there's no question Jared's ability, right? Like, he was, I think, a 6th overall pick at one point, and ultimately, like, it was just getting him into kind of a free space, you know, both mentally and physically, to, like, hey man, just go get as many good swings off as you can, kind of thing. And for the last, you know, 2.5-3 weeks, he's kind of executed that. So it's a credit to him. I give a ton of credit to our staff down there for lack of a better word, kind of grinding it out and getting him into a good place.
Mentioned that mental side of the game. When it's someone like Shane Smith, who had some success here and then he's working through doing some things down there, what's that sort of aspect like, just trying to keep him sharp, not only physically but also mentally as well?
Yeah, no, it's, again, I point to, I've said this before, but the frame of mind that Shane was in when he went down there, I think, is significant. You know, I think he's had 3 starts down there. He'll make another one this week. There's been a little bit of up and down, right? I think he would tell you the same thing. But again, I think that the belief for him and for us is that, you know, this is a blip on the radar. He was a Major League All-Star last year. We know what he can do. I think he knows what he can do. And, like, you know, the nature of the conversations are really, like, just alluding to the fact that he's going to do it again, right? Like, is it perfect right now? No, it's not. He would tell you the same thing. But what I do know is that he's working. And, again, to give credit to, like, our AAA staff and the pitching group down there, we're doing what we can to get him into a good spot, and knowing that he understands where he wants to go, and it's not be in Charlotte, it's be back here in Chicago, and hopefully it's in short term.
Braden's a couple months away, but do you work a little bit with, you know, Mike Shirley and his group in terms of the whole, obviously number one is number one, but the whole draft process with, what, you know, the pool that you guys will have and all that?
Yeah, we communicate a lot about it a lot leading up to the draft. I have the opportunity to come here and get exposed to a lot of the pre-draft meetings, and, you know, get to listen to all the scouts talk about all the players. With my college coaching background, I have a little bit of a unique network with, you know, college coaches and just amateurs in general, so I actually really enjoy the process, you know, and I really enjoy having the opportunity to communicate with our scouts, talk about, you know, Sam Antonacci and why we feel like we had success, and, like, if we can find another one of those, that'd be really cool. But yeah, I am involved with it, you know, kind of peripherally. You know, I'm not telling Mike who to pick, right?
Right,
but,
right.
But it's, I actually, like I said, I really enjoy that process, and there's so much information now on all of the players. It's actually pretty cool to be a part of.
What kind of difference can a 1-1 make for an organization that's already, you know, developing some depth and some talent across the board?
Yeah, it's just, you know, the nature of the way that it works, obviously there's some luck involved to getting that pick.
Right.
You know, I'm kind of a big think lucky, be lucky guy. So, like, I think the impact is significant. Obviously, you're subject to who's available in that particular draft or whatever. But it's very fortunate to be in the position, and I'm glad to and have a lot of trust in Mike and his group to make a good pick.
Jacob Gonzalez has been through a lot of swing tweaks over the last couple of years. What's kind of clicked for him now? You know, obviously, in the right ballpark for more power to show up.
It is an offensive park, but I'll give Jacob a ton of credit because he has made some adjustments. If you've watched, you know, video, right, he looks a little different, right? The hands are a little lower, similarly to kind of what we talked about with Colby Shelton, but really is trying to get him into a frame of mind of where he's comfortable taking shots, right? He's got pop. Like, it's not like he can't hit the ball out really to all parts of the park, you know, and with 2 strikes, you battle, right? But, like, to his credit, he's in as good a spot as I've seen him. And, you know, we talk about, like, development timelines not being the same for everybody, and I think he's probably a good example of that. But he's gotten himself, you know, he's at the AAA level. He's one step away, waiting for the right situation to present itself. But up to this point in the year, like, he's played really well. And we're talking about offense, but, you know, he's also one of our you know, more reliable defenders at all three infield positions. So it's, he's got some things in his corner, and hopefully at some point this year he gets his chance.
Did you look at him in the outfield at all? I mean, he said he kind of played everywhere coming up, so he said he's willing to do kind of whatever.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I don't think at this juncture he's played some first in Charlotte this year, and obviously all three other infield positions. At this point, I don't think we'll play with the outfield just yet, and really it's just more a function of we kind of got enough guys that can do that it probably doesn't make a ton of sense to add one more thing to his plate.
It was a slow start for Braden to begin the year, but obviously he found his groove very quickly. What does he need to keep working on to show the team that his timeline might be sped up and what promotion could look like for him?
Yeah, no, he's give Braden a ton of credit. He's off to, you know, maybe relatively slow start for a couple weeks, but it's kind of right of the ship or whatever. And they did make some mechanical tweaks, you know, a couple weeks ago that obviously clicked, and he's really been swinging the bat great. But and honestly, he's answered every challenge up to this point that we've kind of given him over the last year. And you know, it's only a second full season of pro ball, but you know, again, he's just such a unique ability, right? And like I point to the competitor too, like this is the way I describe Braden. Like, he doesn't want to be good, he wants to be great, and that's like a really valuable, you know, just mentality to have. But yeah, so he's in a great spot. Again, he's answered every challenge, and I think he'll be looking for a new challenge at some point in the near future.
Do you guys put emphasis on like bat speed training in spring, and you know, installing like an offensive program? Are the results you're seeing, does it feel like it's stemming from that in terms of the more power production?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, we've got actually some pretty compelling data. You guys need to put Ryan Fuller on the podium to ask him about it, but we have seen an uptick across the org in bat speed. And you know, and there we have some, you know, some specific examples we could point to that have experienced, you know, success or whatever this year, and definitely something that's just part of the program now. Like we're going to continue to implement it and try to be creative with how we do it. You know, what does the off season look like versus the in season in terms of a maintenance and continuing to try to improve it? But yeah, it's definitely something that we believe in and are going to continue to promote.
For as advanced as Billy Carlson's club was obviously coming in, is it all about just hitting for him, or is there still stuff he needs to work on defensively?
Yeah. It's actually a really good question because he is super talented defensively. The way that I describe it is he's ahead of the curve defensively. When he gets really good at making as many plays easy as he can, because he has the ability to do so much, he can throw from every angle, he can make, you know, really any play that needs to be made. But understanding if it's like the catcher running versus, you know, the leadoff hitter, some of those kind of like nuances of playing defense, I think are going to continue to help him. But I mean, the kid's a worker, right? Like, that's what I would tell you, like, that is intriguing to me and, like, exciting. Offensively, numbers aside, I mean, which are fine, I still believe his floor is higher than people may have thought going into the draft. Again, highlighting that young group, highlighting Jason Nix being in Kannapolis to kind of, like, lead that young group and knowing, like, you know, the way that he appreciates the game of baseball, I think is really big for those young guys. But yeah, Billy's doing great, and again, the thing that sticks out is how hard he plays. He shows up every day. If he's not in the lineup, based on our aspiration to keep him healthy for the whole year and fresh, you know, he's not real happy about it, which I think is good context.
Again, that was White Sox Director of Player Development Paul Janisch meeting with us, the media, on Wednesday prior to the White Sox final game of their homestand. That last answer, if you couldn't make it out, was my question. In response to my question about Billy Carlson, who I asked Janisch about him being so advanced with the glove defensively, you know, many scouts said that Billy Carlson is the best defensive high school shortstop they had ever scouted. And a lot of people think his glove might be major league ready already. And so I was asking, you know, what does Carlson need to do developmentally? Not just with the bat, but is there anything more that he needs to do defensively? And that's where you heard Janisch kind of talk about Billy being a worker and how he thinks his floor is actually higher than most other people actually believed it was in last year's draft. So good stuff there regarding the White Sox farm system. Always good to hear Paul Janisch talk about what the White Sox have going on organizationally. White Sox fans, the Crosstown Series is coming to the South Side. Grab your friends and family and head to the Raitt Field Friday, May 15th through Sunday, May 17th to cheer on your Chicago White Sox. Great lower-level tickets are still available. To purchase tickets, to the Crosstown Series, visit whitesox.com/tickets. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. We had a fantastic guest in the booth with Len Casper and Darren Jackson this past, was that Monday? That was Monday, right, Brendan? I'm trying to think it through. When did we have the rain delay? I believe it was Monday when we had the extended 3-hour rain delay. And we actually did not have the start of the game until 9:40 that evening when the White Sox were playing the Angels. Yeah, it was the first game of the series that the White Sox played against the Angels, the one that they won 8-7 on a 7th spot in the 7th inning. And Brendan Hunt was in the booth with Len Casper and Darren Jackson. You may know him from Ted Lasso. It was a fantastic listen, so we're going to bring that to you here coming up in a moment. Take a quick timeout right here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The home of the Sox. This is ESPN Chicago.
Sox fans, upgrade your game day with a private suite, the perfect space to host your closest friends and family with customizable food and beverage options. For more information, visit whitesox.com/suites or call 312-674-1000. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly as we are getting set for White Sox and Padres. Game number 2 of 3 of this series as the White Sox took the opener yesterday evening. They won 8-2, and now it'll be Sean Burke up against Michael King tonight. But we'll have more on that during the official pregame show, which begins at 7 o'clock. First things first, though, I wanted to run this back because you may have missed it. There was a 3-hour rain delay before we even got first pitch underway on Monday evening at Wright Field. So 9:40, there might have been a lot of White Sox fans who maybe you work early on Tuesday, so you had to pack it in. Maybe you didn't get a chance to listen to this. It was a fantastic in-booth interview as Brendan Hunt, who plays Coach Beard on Apple TV's Ted Lasso, joined Len Casper and Darren Jackson inside our booth during the White Sox-Angels game. And I'll note, there is some play-by-play action going on here, but it is well worth it because Brendan Hunt actually did a batter of play-by-play to wrap up his in-person interview with Len and DJ. Again, he plays Coach Beard on Apple TV's Ted Lasso, which I know a lot of folks are huge fans of. And he actually, Brendan Hunt, actually gave us a little bit of a tease inside of this interview where he noted there was a big announcement coming out. The announcement, I'll spoil it here, is that Ted Lasso, the release date for season 4 was announced later that evening when they dropped the trailer August 5th. It will be streaming on Apple TV. But Brendan Hunt has a one-man show going on in Chicago right now, which is partly why he was there in attendance. And so I will let Len Casper and Darren Jackson and Brendan Hunt do the rest of the speaking here.
And we have a special guest in the booth, Brendan Hunt. You might know him better as Coach Beard, a Chicago native, back for a few weeks, a one-man show. We're going to hear all about it as Carroll chops back to the pitcher and Kohanowicz will underhand to first. Brendan, great to have you back here. And thanks for hanging out after a long rain delay.
Well, great to be here, fellas, and thanks for having me. And thanks for knowing what Ted Lasso is, because I turned in the lineup card, which was a great thrill and great honor, and quickly discovered that no one in the Major League Baseball umpire community has any idea what Ted Lasso is. They were completely disinterested, and it was a real blow to the confidence. So thanks, fellas.
Well, I was going to ask you how that went.
That's awesome.
Here is Andrew Benintendi. He's 0-for-1, and he takes a strike. So the movement you need, an evening with Brendan Hunt.
Yes, sir.
Give us, after this pitch, a synopsis.
Sure.
The 0-1, swing and a miss.
A couple years ago, I got to meet Paul McCartney in London. And when I met him,
he's a musician, DJ.
Yeah. You should Google that guy. There's a lot going on there. And
Ebony and wrong guy.
No, that's half the right guy.
The 0-2 coming, and it's outside.
And like, I didn't want to fan out on him, but I had to try really hard not to, because like, I've had many moments in my life overlap with Beatles music, And I had to try really hard to push it all down.
The 1-2 is tapped foul.
And so, when you push something all down, it's got to come out. So, every night at the show, I tell the audience everything that I could not tell Paul McCartney.
I love it.
Oh, that's good stuff. Does that mean the show changes every night?
That doesn't.
1-2 is high and outside. By the way, I'm in your demo that way. Like, I could see myself, like, all the things I would want to say.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. That is outstanding.
But it is different every night, at least a little bit, I'll tell you.
2-2, and he got him looking.
Oh, brother.
So Steppenwolf?
Yep, Steppenwolf Theater. Yeah. The legendary, the theater dojo we know as Steppenwolf. It's an honor to perform there. Never performed there before. I've only understudied, and I never got on stage. And at this point, honoring Mr. Murakami, I would like to mention that I took 2 years of Japanese in high school. At Kenwood Academy. And you have demonstrated
ball one.
A great familiarity, and I retained three phrases from my 2 years of studying Japanese, phrases that I taught myself.
I love it.
Here we go here just a second.
The 1-0 swung on and missed.
Toki doki watashi tachi wa pikuniku ni ikimasu, which means sometimes we go on picnics. Shaku hayaku donatsu wo kudasai, which means please bring me 1,000 donuts quickly.
Oh, no, that's kanpiki ne.
Most importantly, nihongo wo nashimasen, I do not speak Japanese.
Oh, Brendan Hunt is with us. He's in town, a one-man show at the Steppenwolf Theater. And I've got a website if you'd like to check it out inside, steppenwolf.org.
That's right.
/movement to catch Brendan. And I mentioned Coach Beard, the amazing show Ted Lasso that you co-created. And I have a question for you after
this
2-0. And Arnaud takes outside. Did you pattern when you created that character? What were you thinking of? Like, was there a real coach or person in the world that you thought would make a good Coach Beard, so to speak, called Strike?
Yes. I went to Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois.
Twin Cities.
And Central Illinois was, of course, quite the...
swing and a miss, 3-2.
Quite the flatland. I worked... My student job was I was a stagehand at the concert hall on campus, Braden Auditorium, and I would work day-to-day with these guys who were like, you know, Central Illinois, salt-of-the-earth cats.
Right. 3-2 pitch is hit foul.
Who were just extremely stoic. they hardly spoke. They had incredible mullets. They had wraparound sunglasses. And when they spoke, they used words like nomenclature. Like... That had a huge effect on me.
That is great.
And, I'm basically channeling those cats whenever I'm playing Coach Beard.
3-2 misses inside, and Darno walks. We saw some of that tonight when you were introduced on the center field board. And I'm sure you've heard this before, but you get laughs by saying nothing.
Oh,
it's the look.
Sweet.
It's the facial expression. I mean, we were dying up here. DJ was going, yeah. This is great stuff.
Yes.
Just watching you stare into the camera's soul.
Well, thank you. And for those of you listening in Radioland, I'm doing that stare right now. And it's hilarious.
Works for us.
Teodoso, he shows bunt, and he takes low and outside. Now, I heard a rumor that big Harold Baines fan?
That is correct.
Have you met Harold?
Well, I got to do the first pitch here a couple years ago, which was a huge thrill. And they asked me, you know, who my favorite player was, and that 83 team had a big effect on me and particularly loved Harold. And they surprised me by bringing Harold into the room. And, like, there was cameras around, and I didn't go, like, why are there cameras here? I come into a room, like, here's your Harold Baines jersey. Harold Baines jersey? Amazing! And then in walks Harold Baines, and I think I literally went, oh, good, good!
Don't worry, I do that every time I see him, too.
But right before he came in,
1-1 to Teodoso. Docio's outside.
They were asking me, like, you know, like, what do you like about Harold? And I was like, oh, just a bunch of things. But one, like, random fact I remember, in 83, he led the league in a stat that they don't have anymore, which is game-winning RBIs. He had 20 game-winning RBIs, and I always thought that was so cool. Harold comes in. He's a, tell me you know my stats.
The 2-1 pitch swung on and missed 2-2.
You know my stats. I don't even know my stats. Well, no, I was just saying, you know, I was remembering that you had... you know, 20 game-winning RBIs. It was 22.
Yes.
You literally just said you didn't know your stats. It was the best. Like he also had not seen Ted Lasso. He should be an umpire.
Pitch is inside.
He does that in the offseason, yeah.
Yeah. 3-2 softball. So, yes. You know, you're doing the one-man show. One time in my life I saw a one-man show. It was in Arizona, John Amos.
Wow.
Yeah. Haley's Comet. He did this in Scottsdale, Arizona, and it was phenomenal. A one-man show was just unbelievable.
Swinging a ground ball past the diving Vargas. That's a base hit to left. So two on, nobody out.
Anybody that doesn't understand how memorable and how moving a one-man show is, because the work that you guys have to do on your own, I mean, it truly was one of the more memorable plays that I had seen. And, of course, John Amos. So, yeah,
well,
that didn't hurt.
I mean, John Amos is a heck of a high bar to aim for. But, I mean, it is a really fun show to do. And it's fairly Lasso-esque in that I'm trying to make it, you know, pretty gosh darn funny, but also there's heartfelt moments, and then we, just when you think it's getting too heartfelt, we pop the balloon with a yuck.
Uh-huh.
Zach Neto fouls out of play.
And that's yuck with a Y-U-K, not a Y-U-C-K. I'm not grossing anyone out. Just yuck, 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 yuck.
Well, I was thinking about hard-boiled eggs a minute ago, but okay, now we're talking about humor. Gotcha. Okay,
we'll explain that off the air.
Two on, nobody out, fourth inning.
I've never seen a triple play live.
Well, you might hear a swing and a miss on a change.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It's been a while. I'm trying to think of the last triple play we've seen.
A shout out to everyone at the stadium who stayed here. And for those who couldn't wait for the 3-hour rain delay, thank you, because the acoustics are amazing.
Yes. You got that right. In a stadium like this, when you, well, the sound of the ball hitting the catcher's mitt, we hear it.
When the Angels had their first hit, I was with my wife. She was like, "Oh, wow, you can hear some Angels fans." No, dear, those are the actual Angels. You can hear the Angels.
Fouled away.
I thought when you're a big star, you weren't supposed to admit that you're married, so all the single women would come out and chase you.
Where were you 2 minutes ago, Darren? I blew it. Going to be a quiet night on Rush Street tonight.
Two strikes on Zach Neto. Here's the pitch by Kay. And he missed off the outside corner on a changeup.
And speaking of this 3-hour rain delay, during which I had far too many beers, because I think it's a Monday night, and despite the clear importance of what is happening here on this field, there might be less people listening than usual, fewer people.
Yes.
Use the correct grammar.
Yes.
So,
here's a 1-2. Neto fouls.
Oh, that would have killed me. You mentioned Ted Lasso earlier. Guys, no one knows this yet. And because, again, of who all's listening right now, still I'm going to say it, and then still no one will know it. But I believe there's a big announcement coming up.
Oh.
Within hours.
Hey. Okay.
And that's all I can tell you.
Oh. Nice tease.
Thank you.
As they say, called strike three to get Neto.
Nice.
And look. You admitted that, you know, the audience might be a little lower than normal because usually, I mean, we're off the charts. But, give us a heads up right now. Just, you know, a little too early to give us a little.
Oh, what the thing is?
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
No, we're done here. No pressure.
I mean, gosh, I what I gave you wasn't enough, Darren. That was an exclusive.
Trust me.
That was an international exclusive.
I had more beers than you on the break.
I knew I liked you.
Mike Trout, and he hits a ground ball. Fair, gloved by Vargas. Oh, he's going to throw late to first. Bases loaded. He had nowhere to go, basically. Was in foul territory, but he fired to first. Mike Trout easily beats out an infield hit.
It was a heck of a pick.
Yeah, that play is a great play, but the idea after it, not so much. Because when you look to third base and you go, I can't get there. You look to second base, you're ready to throw, and you say, I can't get him. And then you throw to first base with Mike Trout running. That's probably the wrong decision. I'm just saying.
So we'll have a conversation, pitcher and catcher on the mound. We're chatting with Brendan Hunt. He's got a one-man show here in Chicago. You should absolutely check it out. We'd also like to welcome our listeners tuned in tonight on Fox River Valley's WRMN, 1410 AM in Elgin, Illinois.
other than the projects that we know about already, you have something in the works down the line that we should be looking out for?
I'm writing a book about baseball.
Love it.
Right.
About tonight, of course.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's an oral history of a rain delay and the time that my love for my wife cost me dozens of groupies.
Here's Vaughn Grissom, and he takes inside.
But yeah, because I, and some people aren't going to like this, but I'm tired of hiding it. I'm going to live my truth. I'm a Northside child of Southside parents, and I'm one of those people who I like both teams.
Oh, whoa.
And I don't want to hear any guff from Darren, who played for both teams.
Yes, he did. The pitch is low, ball two.
So well, this book will go about explaining how that happened.
No, that's the best. Look, we already talked about this between innings, but I grew up in L.A., a Dodgers fan, but an Angels fan, too. I mean, a baseball fan in the end. That's what it comes down to.
Truly.
Well, have you ever called play-by-play?
I have not, no.
Well, you want to call this next pitch?
Sure, all right, okay.
You got Kay and Soler. I'll let you take it from there.
I kind of have to go into an announcer voice that no one's going to like, but Soler, the right-handed native of Havana, Cuba, faces the pitch. It's a strike, called strike, slow call by the home plate umpire who has never streamed a television show in his life. Does not affect the quality of his work. It's 0-2, runners at second. And first base. Those are two of the three bases.
Okay.
All right. Kay brings it in. Again, no call by the umpire. Very slow. I'm inferring it was a ball.
It was
a ball. For those of you who played deuces, we're one ball away. Get your wagers ready. Wagering illegal.
Hey, look, you're putting people's jobs on in jeopardy right now with this. You better take it easy.
Jorge Soler, 6'3", 235, according to the scoreboard. But if you ask Jorge, he's 6'4", 222.
Oh, baby.
Two-time World Series champion. Again, I'm just reading that scoreboard. Oh, my gosh. It's another ball. And I got to tell you, the deuces being shouted around this stadium can be heard audibly in every single corner. The slow strike calls on the umpire are just making everything very suspenseful. You never know if it's a ball or a strike. Here comes Kay with the money pitch. Uh-oh. Oh, it's out to left field. And that's three outs. And they've retired the side, giving up just one run. And as we go to the bottom of what we call the fourth inning, it is 4-0.
One of the better guest play-by-plays there done by Brendan Hunt, who, of course, plays Coach Beard on Ted Lasso Season 4 coming August 5th. And, of course, Brendan has the one-man show at the Wolf. Why am I? I'm blanking there. Brendan, I know the name of it, and it's just, it's evading me as we speak. Yep. I'll get it for you, folks. Forgive me because my mind is just blanking there. Anyway, fantastic, though. It was a great, great interview with Len Casper and Darren Jackson, so I wanted to bring it to you because it did occur so late in the evening after the long rain delay. So Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. Steppenwolf. I was like, Wolf. I got Wolf stuck in my head. Steppenwolf. Steppenwolf Theater. All right. So when we come back, we have a couple of interesting food-related items from around Major League Baseball that I want to share with you coming up next right here on ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
It's simple. The ESPN Chicago app.
Jeff Meller back on White Sox Weekly. Wanted to share a couple of nuggets from around Major League Baseball earlier this week. May have missed this one, but in Cincinnati, the Reds have a promotion for fans who attend the game. When the Reds strike out 11 batters during a game, the fans in attendance with their ticket win free pizza at a local Cincinnati Reds establishment. Well, we've seen a lot of great ABS challenges this season. How about when pizza's on the line? A call that was originally ball four was challenged, and this is how it sounded as that call was eventually overturned.
Just missed. ABS
Pass Challenge powered by T-Mobile.
The catcher has challenged to call a ball.
Stevenson's 1-1 tonight. Can he win pizza for those in the stands? The crowd ready to burst. That's a strike! Pizza for everybody! He does it for the people.
I just love that the crowd, you've got these ABS moments now when they're flipped, and not just for, think about it, for huge calls. Maybe we saw a few where Edgar Caro was able to get a call overturned and, you know, from a what cost the White Sox a run on a ball four walk where he got it flipped to a strikeout. That obviously was a huge challenge, but how about for free pizza, folks? That's the best kind of challenge one for your fans. You love that. And then how about this one? Jim Palmer, Major League Baseball Hall of Famer, for the longtime pitcher for the Baltimore Orioles, longtime broadcaster as well, turned 80 this year. And apparently Jim Palmer had never tried fried chicken. And I don't know what convinced him to finally try it this week, but he did, and he did so on the Orioles broadcast.
A lot of skin, that's all I can tell you. So, and they're greasy, by the way. Can't eat them with a microphone.
This is television gold. I'm so happy to be a part of this. Listen, Jim Palmer tried to work his little magic. I went all around the stadium to try to find wings, and all the wing spots were closed. But fortunately, our PR staff was
there. Yes, that would have been my day.
Jim would have the power to call all of the concession stands. Thankfully, our PR staff scrounged some up. So you're having your first wings?
Actually, these are pretty good.
Look at that.
That's what I've missed all these years.
I do like green eggs and ham. You could have had maybe not 80 years of this, like 76 years of chicken wings.
I don't know if that's good or bad to finally discover that you like chicken wings after you turned 80. And I was trying to fathom, what in my life have I not tried at this point in my life that is just something so basic and quintessential to Americana? I can't believe Jim Palmer went that long without trying a chicken wing and fried chicken. He admitted he never had tried both, so I thought that was kind of amusing. He finally did so at 80 years old on the Masson television broadcast of the Orioles game earlier this week. When we come back, we'll get you set for our White Sox pregame coverage, which officially begins at 7 o'clock right here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The legendary AM 1000, the home of the Chicago White Sox.
Jeff Meller back wrapping up White Sox Weekly. Pregame coverage will begin in 4 minutes, 7 o'clock Central Time here on your home of the White Sox. Join us at the ballpark on Saturday, June 13th for Sox Crawl Fiesta on 35th Street, presented by Trace Agaves. Enjoy an exclusive pregame crawl inside the stadium with special $5 menu items, entertainment, and more. Plus, receive a Colson Montgomery bobblehead presented by Rate. Fans must be 21 years or older to attend. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sox Crawl. All right, stick around. Pregame coverage begins here momentarily. Thanks to Kendra Smith and Brennan Riley. We'll talk to you here in 3 minutes on ESPN 1000.